David Goldman. I can't say enough about David Goldman. He is a man of parts. He's made a career as a strategist in the financial industry, head of credit strategy for Credit Suisse, head of fixed income research at the Bank of America. But in college, he studied mathematics, economics, and music. He studied economics at the London School and music theory at the City University of New York. He taught music theory at Madison College of Music, where he currently serves on the Board of Governors. He also serves on the Board of Directors of the American Israel Cultural Foundation. From 1994 to 2001, he was a columnist for Forbes magazine, but he began writing on politics, geopolitics, intelligence for the Asia Times Online 2001. He's been writing some of the most incisive and sobering essays under a name that reflects his dark, melancholy view of the forces at work in the world. He's been writing under the name of Spengler. And within those essays, he produced some of the most searching critical pieces on Barack Obama. He did a very striking piece on two women who helped define Obama. And that piece, I think, caught something not widely seen. He joined us at the journal First Things as a senior writer, and he's been the adornment of that journal. He's receded from a kind of full-time engagement with First Things, but he still contributes pieces, and sampling indicates the range of his interests recently, just a few titles. This more recent issue, August, September, he wrote a piece on Wagner's incestuous narcissism. December 2010, why we can't hear Wagner's music. September 2010, the God of the mathematicians, the religious beliefs that guided Kurt Gödel's revolutionary ideas. But his interests have encompassed Jewish theology as well as literature. He's been appearing on Larry Kudlow of late, on his talks on the market. He's been one of the commentators, usually with something very precise to offer in an interesting way, and it probably accounts for why they keep inviting him back. With the worries over Greece, Italy, and Portugal, he drew on Casablanca to caution those who are inflating the crises, and he remarked that the problem of these three countries don't amount to a hill of beans in this vast world economy. His most jarring commentaries have been on the Arab Spring and the desperate situation in Egypt, portending starvation. But he appears here also at the time of the publication of the new book, which we ought to bring back to this audience, How Civilizations Die. Just the sobering message we need in the aftermath of the disaster in Amherst. We've had some of the worst, most depressing time in Amherst I've seen in 45 years. But the counterpoint to this is that David is a tonic. He lifts our spirit every time by offering us accounts alive with facts and forces, with genius and plots abounding. I was just going to say that David is the only one who could probably make a musical about the end of the world. But I guess David would make it into an opera, and I would make it into a Broadway show. Ladies and gentlemen, help me invite, and join me in welcoming David Cole Goldman.
Hadley, and about my humility, you say nothing?
Nothing.
the honor of appearing here before this distinguished company at a conference addressed by people like Mike McConnell and James K. Wilson and Hadley Arkus is one of the high points of my life, and I thank you very much, Hadley, for allowing me to do this. In keeping with the idea of the American founding, I'd like to say something about the American founding, which bears indirectly on the problem of the Arab Spring and puts it in context, because the issues that bear in the Arab Spring are not unique to the Arabs or to Muslims in general. I think they reflect a more universal issue. And I'd like to talk about one of the things that motivated the American founding. What was it that caused the Pilgrim Fathers to come to these shores in 1620 in particular? They didn't wake up one morning and say, gee, it might be a nice idea to get in the boat and come to a place you've never seen before. Something very specific was going on. something called the 30 Years' War. Just out of curiosity, for my own satisfaction, indulge me. By show of hands, how many people have studied at least a little bit the Peloponnesian War in this room? And how many people have studied the 30 Years' War? A somewhat smaller number. The 30 Years' War bears on our issues in an important way, because 2 years into that war, the Protestant side, which had begun with the revolt against Austrian rule in Bohemia, had been crushed by the counterattack of the Austrian Empire. The Empire had struck back. The Protestants were in a rout, and the Pilgrims, who were rather radical Protestants sitting in Holland and something to the fringe of even the Dutch Reformed Church, which was under siege by the Spanish, were afraid the Spanish were about to invade, which invade they did a couple of years later, and they did come within a few dozen miles of Amsterdam. It was a very touch-and-go thing. And William Bradford, the leader of the separatists in Holland, said, 12 years of truce were now out, and there was nothing but beating of drums and preparing for war. The events whereof are always uncertain. The Spaniard might prove as cruel as the savages of America, and the famine and pestilence as sore here as there, and liberty less to look out for remedy. It was the collapse of European civilization during the 30 Years' War which forced them out of Holland. The 30 Years' War continued to 1648, with the result that, by most estimates, roughly two-fifths of the population of Central Europe died, mostly by starvation and disease. Cannibalism became widespread. Roughly a quarter of the population of Castile, the home province of Spain, was eliminated, and very large parts of France were depopulated. And this war eventually became a Franco-Spanish duel fought out on European soil. The war had a number of consequences. One is the founding of America, because over time, the losers in the war, who were the Protestants who had originally begun it, migrated in very large numbers to the United States, both English and German. That's why you had so many Anabaptists. That's why you have New Paltz, New York. That was the people from the Palatinate. Another consequence was the founding of what's called political rationalism. The first great intellectual response to the war was Hobbes' Leviathan, which says, in effect, look how stupid religion is, because you have these terrible wars over religion, and it's just, religion is stupid to begin with. Human beings are concerned with self-preservation, and you need a system of government which allays that need for self-preservation and answers human fears. Supernatural and transcendent issues are just the cause of trouble. These were religious wars, but probably the only historian, I think, to nail the religious character of the 30 Years' War was Aldous Huxley, who wrote a fabulous biography of the head of intelligence for Cardinal Richelieu, the great mastermind of the war, Father Joseph. What Huxley, the only two people, by the way, Hadley, who actually read Huxley's book that I know were myself and Russell Hittinger. Distinguished church historian at University of Tulsa. These were, in fact, religious wars, but they weren't Catholic-Protestant wars, and they weren't simply dynastic wars. The leading figures in the war, Richelieu on the French side, the Count Duke Olivares, the Spanish Prime Minister on the other side, deeply believed, respectively, in the chosenness of France and of Spain. And the war was fought to the terrible conclusion. Essentially, it was fought to the point where there were simply not enough people left to put in the field. Europe was so bled to death that the war had to stop, because the principals looked to their own nation as the incarnation of God's will on earth, and because France, respectively, or Spain was the chosen nation, any unspeakable atrocity was justified in pursuit of their agenda, which was identified with God's agenda. So the reason Christianity died in Europe is not because Christians fought over how to take communion or whether one is justified by faith alone or other theological issues. What you might call national heresies dominated the main countries of Europe, and each of the European nations in turn believed that they were the chosen people. Of course, you see this in Dostoevsky with Russia as the only God-bearing nation, and finally you see it in Germany with the idea of the Herrengeschlecht, the master race, as a diabolical perversion of the idea of chosen people. Another idea of chosenness was brought to the United States. Terrific book by Eric Nelson called The Hebraic Republic, which is probably the state-of-the-art scholarship, which has been repeated many times, about the sense of a new chosen people in a new promised land, a new mission in the wilderness, which motivated the founders of the United States, at least in New England, what Lincoln ultimately called the almost chosen people. And the great issues in world history since then, in my view, have been fought out between these two ideas of election: an idolatrous nationalist idea of election, and the American idea of emulating Israel, but in a nation which has no ethnicity and therefore is incapable of ethnic idolatry. What happened to Europe in the post-war period, after two world wars of the 20th century, which Winston Churchill characterized as a new 30 years war, is a form of despondency, which we have not seen in Western civilization really since the decline of Rome in the 5th and 6th centuries, or the decline of Greece in the 3rd and 4th centuries, where female infanticide became so common that population simply dwindled. And that despondency correlates with a loss of faith. The question is, in what did Europe lose its faith? There's been an enormous amount of literature on this. That, you know, if you look at countries like Italy, for example, or Poland, or Germany, which have a fertility rate of 1.3, replacement fertility is 2.1, any projected forward, they disappear. This will be the first time since classical antiquity that we have large, successful nations in conditions of peace and prosperity who simply will themselves out of existence. At this birth rate in 200 years, there will be 2% as many German speakers as they are now. By the middle of the century, 60% of the population of Italy will be collecting a pension. So if you buy a 30-year bond from the Italian government now, there will be roughly, you know, a third fewer people by the time that bond matures to pay you back. It's not surprising that Europe has a financial crisis. Poland, the Poland of John Paul II, one of the greatest men of my lifetime, that great friend of the Jewish people, has one of the lowest fertility rates in Europe. If you just go to the United Nations Population Prospects website and project current fertility rates forward, one interesting fact that comes out is that Israel, with a Jewish fertility rate of 3, will have roughly 25 million people at the end of this century, and Poland will have 24 million people, except the average age of Poland will be 57, which probably means there'll be so many people in Israel, the Jews will have to move back to Poland. Obviously, we don't know what's going to happen. Linear projections never work out, but we do have a point of no return in many of the European countries, where the current generation is so small that in order to get back on track, you'd have to have a fertility rate of 4 or 5 to get enough women of childbearing years in the following generation. So you get into a spiral which is very hard to get out of, that no country ever has. So it really seems that a large number of great and important countries, Japan, Italy, Poland, Germany, Spain, are lost. Exactly what the consequences will be is not clear. The despondency of Europe, after having fought for hundreds of years under the banner of its own nationalism and finding out that that was a failing proposition, is testimony to how important a sense of the future is to human beings. If you worship yourself, you eventually become the god that failed, and you cease to see a reason to exist and cease to see a reason to have children. I know of no other way to explain this self-willed extinction on the part of the Europeans. The vehemence of jihadi violence is the other side of the coin from European despondency. Because just in the past 10 years, demographers have noticed something which is probably the strangest and spookiest development in the entire history of that profession. Many Muslim countries are going through what they call the Great Fertility Transition, this shift from families of 7 or 8 to 1 or 2. That it took Europe a century, but some of the Muslim countries are doing it in a single generation. And the evidence for this really became available 7 or 8 years ago. It's now being discussed widely, but it's not generally known. And I'd like to talk about three countries in that context relating to the Arab Spring, the principal topic of my talk, pardon the long-winded introduction. Egypt, Iran, and Turkey. Iran certainly is the country in the world which presents the most aggressive profile. There are not many other countries in the world which talk about annihilating their neighbors, for example, the State of Israel. It's not a typical thing in international relations, and it's certainly one of the most barbarous regimes on the planet. There are very few regimes which execute people for being gay. When Mahmoud Ahmadinejad spoke at Columbia 3 years ago and said there are no gays in Iran, he might be right. They might have killed them all. There are not many regimes that, because Islamic law forbids the execution of virgins, arranges for their rape in prison before hanging them the next morning. It's quite a horrible regime. But it's also is a country with one unique attribute. It has the fastest fertility decline of any country ever measured in all of history. 20 years ago, the average Iranian family had 7 children. It's now 1.5. That's a startling fact, which has not gone unnoticed by the Iranian leadership. Ahmadinejad has given speeches in Persian saying, this is genocide. To have so few children is the genocide of the Persian nation. We will die out, we'll become extinct, and we have to stop this. And there's extensive discussion in Persian language sites. As a practical matter, if you take a population pyramid that looks like this, with a lot of young people at the bottom, and in one generation you invert it, and they all become old people, in a country where the average person has $4,000 a year to spend, a very large number of people are going to starve to death. When we talk about the problems we have with Medicare and Medicaid with $50,000 of GDP per person, similar problems in Europe, they're extremely difficult to manage, but at least they're within the realm of theoretical possibility. It's not theoretically possible. There's no way you avoid a catastrophe in the case of Iran. So a good deal of Iran's aggressiveness, its apocalyptic sense that they have a short period of time with which to make their mark on the world, to realize the Shia ascendance in Islam, I believe is motivated by the fact that you cannot be an Iranian and fail to understand that your civilization is well past its best use-by date. In Russia in 1989, we found out that there really were not many communists in Russia outside the Politburo. The average Russian were not communists at all. You don't find communists, you don't find Marxists teaching at Russian universities. You have to go to Cambridge, Massachusetts for that. The same is true in Iran. It's one of the least religious countries in the world. According to one report, religious observance weekly is 2% of the population. Mosque attendance is 2%. Iran is rife with social pathologies on a scale which should make us relieved at the relatively minor problems we have now. 5% of the adult population, by UN estimate, are drug addicts. In Tehran, city of 5 million people, the estimates, the number of women involved in prostitution, are in the low hundreds of thousands, which is an astonishing number. It's comparable to Victorian London. It's a country, in other words, where a generation of an oppressive Islamic theocracy has led to people voting with their wombs. And there's also something very important about Iran by comparison to other countries in the world. It is the Muslim country with the highest literacy rate, no thanks to Khomeini and his successors. In fact, the late Shah created a literacy corps where instead of going to the army, young men were allowed to go to villages and teach reading. So it has 90% literacy. And we find across the Muslim world that there is a really perfect correlation between literacy and birth rates, particular educational levels. And it's true by cohorts within each country, it's true by comparison across countries. Muslim women who go to high school go immediately to European-style fertility rates, and university women have 0 to 1. Fertility among university women in the Muslim world is 1 or below. So Iran's success in literacy corresponds to an extremely fast drop in fertility. The next country I'd like to mention is Turkey, which has been discussed as the model of a moderate Islamist democracy and a success story. Turkey certainly has many impressive things. It's the one Muslim country with a really serious university system, produces first-rate people. I used to hire a lot of them on Wall Street. But Turkey is not in good shape. Among people whose native language is Turkish, whose cradle tongue is Turkish, the fertility rate is also 1.5. The Europeanization of Turkey has produced exactly the same result. The reason Turkey as a whole shows a higher fertility rate is because the Kurds in eastern Anatolia are having 4 to 5 children. Now, as many of you know, there's been civil disturbance with a Kurdish minority going back generations. Roughly 40,000 Kurds have been killed in the resistance to the Turkish government. In one generation, half of Turkey's young people will be native Kurdish speakers. There are also many problems in the Turkish economy, which I don't want to go into. I've written a good deal about that. But Turkey is a country whose demographic viability will be profoundly challenged by the rapid growth of minorities. I say rapid growth, and what is a minority will no longer really be a minority within one generation. And this also has not gone unnoticed by the Turkish authorities. Tayyip Erdogan, the Prime Minister of Turkey, has given speeches saying the Turkish nation will cease to exist by 2038 on current trends. Now, why 2038, I really don't know, but if you go to the UN website and play with the numbers, it's as good a guess as any. So again, in Turkey, there's a profound sense of apocalyptic crisis, of doom in the future, which probably has a great deal to do with energizing the somewhat obstreperous behavior that Turkey has shown towards some of its neighbors, like Cyprus and Israel and others, during the last several years. This is not a viable country, and I think the idea that Turkey will somehow be the center of the Middle East and the center of a new Ottoman Empire, as much as some people might like that, the numbers simply aren't there, the people aren't there. Turkey is going to be going into a period of increasing instability, as will Iran over time. And finally, by reference to Egypt, speaking of the American founding, it seems like a very long time ago that I read an editorial in the Weekly Standard comparing the Arab Spring to the American founding. I think it was difficult 6 or 8 months ago to open the papers and not read articles of unbridled enthusiasm about what a wonderful thing that was. Walid Gaon, the Google guy from Abu Dhabi, was the poster boy for the demonstrations, was on the short list for a Nobel Peace Prize. Came to America, got a book deal, did some speaking tours, and appears to have disappeared. He doesn't seem to be very active in Egypt anymore. The kids in Tahrir Square have been replaced by football toughs, Muslim Brotherhood types. it's very difficult to know what's going on because the country really is in chaos. And Egypt, you know, having been involved in development economics a good deal of my career, if you asked me, what do you do about an economy like Egypt, I would say start somewhere else. Egypt is a tragedy. It's a heart-rending situation. Like many dictators in Latin America and elsewhere, the dictators of Egypt from Nasser onwards for 60 years kept people on the farm, ignorant and pregnant, to keep them under control. Egypt is the extreme other side of the spectrum from Turkey and Iran, which are highly literate countries. Functional illiteracy in Egypt is estimated around 45%. Consanguineous marriages, in other words, marriages to first and second cousins, are 30% in Egypt, which betrays a clan-based society. That's why you marry your cousins. If your protection comes in the clan, marriages reinforce that protection. 90% of Egyptian women are subject to genital mutilation still. So this is a country which, except for a very small crust at the top, is still deeply immired in traditional society. Traditional society always has lots of children. Farmers have always had children. They're cheap labor on the farm. Illiterate people have always had children. They don't know how to avoid it. But the result of 60 years of keeping the population backward is that as the modern world changes and as food prices go up because Asians become rich and want to feed more animals, Egypt simply can't compete for food. And one of the main reasons that the uprisings broke out in the Arab world at the time they did, at the beginning of this year, is because food prices had roughly, you know, had tripled or quadrupled on the world market over the last several years. The trouble with Egypt is that Chinese pigs will eat before Egyptian peasants because the Chinese have more money. Now, the result of the uprising is to send the Egyptian economy into a tailspin. Before the Sabbath began, sundown last night, the last news report I saw from my Google alerts was one saying that Egypt's foreign exchange reserves had fallen by two-thirds since the beginning of the uprising to only 2 months' worth of imports. This is a country that has 60% of its people on the farm, and it still imports half of its caloric consumption. It's short roughly $20 billion a year, by my best guess. And it's run by a kleptocratic military that appears to be stealing everything that's not tied down. If you go, as I have, through the Egyptian press and blogs, it looks very much like Russia right after the fall of communism, where anything, rice, wheat, diesel fuel, cooking oil, that can be stolen and put into a container and sold somewhere else is. So even if the West got together at a point where we can't bail out Greece and we may have to bail out Italy and we can barely bail out ourselves and found $20 billion a year for Egypt, I think we're more likely to have a Somalia kind of situation where even if we want to get the aid in, we can't. It'll be stolen too quickly and we'll run into political opposition. Plus, since we'll probably have a Muslim Brotherhood government, I think it's highly unlikely that the U.S. Congress would wish to provide a great deal of aid to a government which is extremely hostile to us and extremely hostile to allies of ours like Israel. The optimism which prevailed on both sides of the political spectrum, the Bush freedom agenda, the belief, the social gospel, Wilsonian idea that by promoting democratic institutions we could create democracies in Arab countries that would be supportive of us, as well as the optimism of a Barack Obama of the Cairo speech 2009, where if you reach out to the Muslim world and show friendship and understanding, we'll be able to put aside many of the animosities of the past. I think both these illusions fail on the facts that as the Muslim world encounters modernity, it crashes and burns. Either you have countries like Egypt and Pakistan, which are so backward and incapable of advancing themselves because of the backlog of illiteracy and other social obstacles to development that they can't compete in the modern world. Or you have countries like Iran and Turkey where people enter the modern world with the same sense of anomie and despair that Stone Age peoples who walk out of the jungle tend to feel when they encounter, you know, traders who sell them alcohol. There are entire tribes in Brazil who, you know, die of alcoholism as they come out of the out of primitive life. And something like that is happening in the Muslim world. Something, in other words, like the despondency of the Europeans who spent centuries worshiping their own nationality, their own culture, their own race, and having failed to succeed, decided that they might as well spend their golden years on a long vacation instead of bothering to have children. Something like that has taken hold of the educated side of the Muslim world. That's why that is the case, long discussion. I don't want to, perhaps we can get to that in the question period, but I'd like to discuss what that means finally for American policy. We have something like the 30 Years War developing in the Middle East. That is a prolonged period in which societies cannot be stabilized, in which large numbers of people will in fact perish for lack of food, disease, or violence. And it's a situation which I don't believe that even if we wish to, we could change. I don't believe that America is responsible for these problems. If anyone is responsible, it's China for raising the price of food by, you know, buying too much grain to feed pigs and chickens. But what does American policy look like in a world where a civilization involving 1.5 billion people, leave Indonesia out of it, leave parts of Western Asia out of it, but very large number of people, is going into a long period of chaos. The United States, the American public, will not tolerate another major effort at nation building as in Iraq, another occupation. I don't think the occupation was a good idea in the first place. I'm all for military expeditions to rid ourselves of enemies who might hurt us. I think it's not the role of the American military to try to build nations, but that's my personal view. Whatever I think, or whatever any one of us think, the American public won't tolerate that again. But we have enormous dangers that may arise out of this for American security. For example, if Iran acquires nuclear weapons, or Pakistan decides to use its nuclear weapons in a way that has hitherto avoided, what's the possibility of terrorists acquiring nuclear weapons or nuclear weapons being used against ourselves and allies? The Iranians have long-range nuclear missiles that could hit any city in Europe. If those missiles get into the hands of, you know, let's say Venezuela, they could hit American cities. You cannot have this level of social breakdown in countries which have access to a great deal of armaments and not impinge in an important way on American interests. It's my belief that American policy will have to shift from either a naive multicultural view, let's say, Barack Obama's famous statement that he believes in American exceptionalism where the Greeks believe in Greek exceptionalism or the Belgians believe in Belgian exceptionalism. I think it's a fatuous statement because America so clearly is a country constituted on a different basis. I think we're going to have to abandon that, and we'll have to abandon the Wilsonian idealism that characterized the George W. Bush administration. The policy which America will be forced on us is one in which we live in a world of chaos. It'll be much more like the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, where, although it wasn't advertised, the Reagan administration did its best to keep the war going and get as many people killed as possible. 1 million people died in that war, and some of that blood is on our hands. You may remember at the time that Henry Kissinger was asked which side he wanted to win. He said, "I want both sides to lose. We should try to arrange that." The Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Shamir, was also asked who he wants to win. He said, "I want them both to win." We'll be in a position where we're forced to operate in a world of instability in ways which often involve humanitarian crises on a biblical scale in ways that we can't control but nonetheless have to respond to as a matter of urgent security interests. So the point of my talk is, first of all, to harden your hearts. Secondly, to horrify you so as to inoculate you with respect to horrors that undoubtedly will come, are unavoidable and out of our control. And third, to argue that America nonetheless has to pursue its own security interests, even in a world which is quite grim. Now, I personally am not a pessimist. I want to point out. I'm optimistic about some things and pessimistic about other things. I want to point out that 2/3 of the world population live in places where life is getting a lot better, like India and China and their periphery, and Brazil, Indonesia, which is a Muslim country. Of the world's people, 2/3 are going through a great transition from rural poverty to urban prosperity. You know, if you visit China, you find people are generally very upbeat. These are people who grew up with dirt floors and outhouses and bicycles, and now they have modern apartments and automobiles. They're quite happy about life, and things are getting better in Latin America. Most of the world is doing better, but a large part of the world is not. And dealing with that is going to be a terrible challenge to us, politically as well as psychological. And that is why I wrote How Civilizations Die. It's not about Islam. The Islamic world simply happens to be in the vortex now of the kind of transition which, you know, reduced Europe to a shadow of itself and parts of Europe to an eventual demographic ruin. The difference is it's happening much more quickly. In a sense, parts of the Muslim world are going from adolescence to senility without passing through adulthood. That challenge is going to be a terrible and difficult one. With that, I think I should probably duck things you're going to throw, and if you're not going to throw them, I'll take your questions. Thank you very much.
Sam Goldwyn has that famous line, "I don't care if I make a nickel on this movie as long as every man, woman, and child in the country sees it." So we can say the same way, we ought to buy this book. You know, you remind me of Michael Novak's account of the difference between the Polish optimist and the pessimist, where the pessimist says things can't get worse, and the optimist says, "Oh, yes, they can." I want to open this to the question, but first I want to ask you to do a connection. I think the most obvious question that would arise is, if these countries are getting debilitated, what's your connection? Why they become a threat? Is it because it's fed out of desperation, or is it the only lever they could use? Dave, would you take that on, and then let's open it to questions, okay?
Well, if you're Iran, and you know that, you know, in a generation, 40% of your people are going to be elderly dependents instead of 10% today, which is comparable to the United States, except you've got a tenth of per capita GDP, and your economy will break down, and at the same time, your oil is going to start running out, not the gas, but the oil will start becoming exhausted. You will look cross-eyed across the Persian Gulf at the Saudi oil fields, which happen to be the Shia areas of Saudi Arabia, at Azerbaijan, and so forth. And if you feel that this is the last chance for Shia Islam to make its case, the last big generation you have, then you may aggressively attempt to acquire nuclear weapons and use acts of terrorism, as Iran has in many cases in the past, more aggressively under a shield of nuclear weapons. If you have, in other words, if we can't retaliate against Iranian terror strikes because they have nuclear weapons that could be dropped, say, on the Saudi oil fields or in Israel or on Rome or on Washington, we've got a very different kind of problem than we have at the moment. It's certainly also the case that countries going through transition in which many people don't see a future, often produce large numbers of terrorists. The largest terrorist episode, the worst in history, is still Russia in the dozen years before 1917. In terms of frequency of terrorist incidents, nothing was ever that bad. And these were former Orthodox Christians turned radicals, and some who were still, in some ways, heretical Orthodox Christians. This is not a Muslim problem. Russia, in its industrial transition, produced what still ranks as the worst terror wave in history by some measures. My friend Anna Geifman at Boston University has written a terrific book about this called Death Orders, which I quote in here. So again, we've seen this problem in the past. We simply haven't seen it on this scale, and we haven't seen it with nuclear weapons.
Okay. Let's open up the questions.
Yes.
About, you mentioned China and India as places of some optimism, but isn't it true that in both those countries, civilizations, that there's roughly 10 to 20% more males than females of childbearing years?
They're terrible.
So they have the same kind of problem?
There are terrible problems. Lots of people will say, well, you know, China's birth rate is extremely low, and don't they have the same demographic problem? Well, yes, they do, but they have 1.5 billion people. And a very large number of the people who are going through the demographic decline are in parts of China which really are not engaged with the world economy. I believe that the one-child policy was effectively a politically motivated genocide against the Chinese peasantry, because dynasties have always been overthrown, where there were too many peasants and not enough land. China's always been short of land. Now they march on the capital. So the Communist Party said, well, if we don't have that many peasants, we're less likely to be overthrown. But at the same time, China at the moment has produced an extraordinary generation of highly educated people. The number of people in China who are economically powerful has decupled in two generations. Just one factoid which I find fascinating: China has 50 million young people studying Western classical music, including 35 million pianists. China produces every year more violins than existed in the world in 1950. This is not, by the way, mainly sponsored by the state. It's mainly parents paying for this, and it's not because that many Chinese want a musical career. It's because Chinese parents, like the Tiger Mom book, know that playing classical music helps make their kids smart in school. So it'll take a very long time for China to exhaust the resources of this enormous wave of talent coming in. We'll see it. We'll stand back in a generation and take the measure of this. In the case of India, India has horrendous problems. India is two countries. It has, of its billion people, you have something like 150 million who are engaged in the modern world, and more than 800 million who are still trapped in a very backward kind of society. So yes, the effects of modern technology, the availability of tests for gender of fetuses, have led to a very high rate of abortion of female fetuses, which fit into the prejudices of traditional society. There are horrendous problems, but India as a country, again, is producing a quality of talent and capacity to do things which is spectacular. Life is getting much better for most Indians, as it's gotten much better for China. I don't mean that there aren't enormous problems, but there's a very good case to be very optimistic about both India and China. There's a pessimistic case, too. I don't see an optimistic case to be made for Iran or for Egypt. And there is an optimistic case for Turkey, but I strongly disagree with it. There's a question behind me.
You mentioned the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, and you said you were pretty sure that they were going to win, at least control the next government. And I just wanted to ask about what you thought about Islam or Sharia law in terms of these new governments rising from the Arab Spring. How much Islam will have?
If you have a society where most public officials are explicitly corrupt, and food is being stolen from warehouses and sold overseas under conditions of shortage, which is the case in Egypt right now, people will fall back on what they know and what they have, and the social glue that holds Egypt together is Islam. Egyptian nationalism never created a civil society. It never created institutions. You don't have nationalist clubs. You don't have political parties. People don't go every Tuesday night to hear nationalist lectures. This was simply an instrument of rule by a relatively small clique at the top, from Nasser to Sadat to Mubarak to, you know, can't even remember the name of the current head of the Supreme Armed Forces Council. So by default, the Muslim Brotherhood or the Islamists take over. The main reason that I think Muslim societies have failed to produce the great scientists and entrepreneurs and people who are effective in the modern world is that they're very much top-down as opposed to bottom-up societies. What's unique about Western society, with America as the great exemplar, is the diffusion of opportunity to individuals. As far as I can tell, talent pops up randomly, and if you have a system where almost any individual has access to education, to capital, to means of empowerment, can start a company or publish a newspaper or do things that affect the world around them, those talented individuals will give the wind behind the sails of a society like the United States. It's quite the opposite. The Muslim world has never developed that. I mean, China, before the revolution, was in the same situation. China had every invention that went into the Industrial Revolution: printing press, clocks, mills, magnetic compass, gunpowder. But when the Jesuits turned up in China, when Matteo Ricci came in the 16th century, he reintroduced many of these inventions to the Chinese, who had forgotten them because they had remained the playthings of an elite. They were never diffused through the rest of society. So that's answering a different question than you asked, anticipating someone else asking as a follow-up. In the back.
Yeah, two questions, if I may. The first question is regarding the fertility rates in Europe and the demographic pyramid challenge that you mentioned. What do you think is the potential for the European nations to manage the demographic pyramid using immigration? As the first question. And then the second question is, can you comment on global fertility and any opinions or observations on global capacity? You talk a lot about national fertility and national implications of fertility, but could you also comment on global fertility?
Yes, yes. The European situation is extremely diverse. The question is, where would you obtain immigrants who fit in and are well integrated? The best example of immigration from a Muslim country is the Turks in Germany. It's not nearly as bad as people make it out to be. You see Turkish kids on German streets, and they sound like German kids after a generation. The problem is the Turks who go to Germany develop German fertility habits within one generation, so that doesn't help them very much. Spain is probably in the best shape because you have Latin America, a very large number of Latin Americans, including highly educated Latin Americans. A lot of reverse immigration from Argentina after the financial crisis of 2000 back to Spain. The emigration out of Latin America to the north has been enormous. Half the working population of Ecuador, admittedly a small country, but 50% of it is working overseas, mostly in Spain. So Spain, because of its colonial past, probably can rescue itself. Germany has had a lot of immigration from Eastern Europe, but Eastern Europe has even lower fertility than Germany, so that doesn't last very long. And as I mentioned, the Turkish issue has its limits. Where Germany would find immigrants who can integrate into German society, which I've lived in Germany. It's challenging to get up in the morning and get around in Germany, let alone become a German. I just don't see them doing it. What I believe will happen is that Europe will be repopulated eventually by Africans, including a lot of African Christians, but because they lack the education levels that the Europeans have, it'll be a much poorer place. That'll be the final next wave of invasion. So your second question was global fertility. That is an enormously differentiated problem because you have countries in Africa which still have fertility rates of 8, and because of antibiotics, relatively low infant mortality. So you have, pick up National Geographic and you read about the tragedy of the Congo and countries around it, where there simply isn't enough land to hold people, and it creates social disturbances and so forth. So there are parts of the world which are still in that cusp, where people have the, they have some access to modern medicine, but still have the habits of traditional society. So you have spectacular population growth rates. But you have other parts of the world, like the whole Muslim world and Latin America, where fertility has fallen much faster than anyone would have predicted. So my best guess, and again, you know, demographics is not a field where forecasting has covered itself in glory for the most part. So we have to be modest in terms of any guess we might have. My best guess is that the pattern that we've seen in the last 20 years will prevail, which is that estimates come in on the low side of expectations. If that's the case, if the so-called low fertility scenario in the United Nations models prevails, we'll start to have a decline in world population before 2100. Modest decline. That would be the result. Sir?
I'm just curious. We read a lot about Muslim integration, emigration into France, into northern European countries. I think I heard that France is now 12% Muslim at this point.
Got no idea.
Well, I don't know. These are figures that I just hear, yeah. And that Muslims are having 4 to 6 kids. So this kind of contradicts what I understood from what you were saying about the decline of, let's call it, I don't know if it's called Islam or Muslim populations or their influence, but I mean, can't the Muslim countries just export their demographics under that kind of scenario? And Denmark is, I think, 10% Muslim. I don't know if my figures are correct, but the numbers are huge compared to what they were a generation ago.
Yeah, I mean, Mark Stein and Bruce Bauer and lots of other people have there are about a dozen books in print on the subject of Eurabia, the Muslim demographic takeover of Europe. From what I can tell, and we ran some things on First Things in this, this is a bit exaggerated, mainly because Europe is so good at corrupting anyone who comes in there. The Senegalese, for example, have eight children at home. But the Senegalese, they're one of the largest French Muslim minorities. Senegal was a French colony. But within 10 years of moving to France, the Senegalese are having 2 or 3 children. It's like Mozart's story about Salzburg. He said, and after you move to Salzburg, in 2 or 3 years you become really stupid. After 4 or 5 years, you become a true Salzburger. So after 10 years, the Senegalese appear to become true Frenchmen. The Pakistanis, on the other hand, in England, still have lots of kids, though they've gone from 8 to 4. And Pakistan's birth rate also has fallen very sharply, but it's still so high relative to the European birth rates that undoubtedly there will be one generation left where the Muslim portion of the population will increase rapidly. But what we see is that Muslim birth rates have been falling much faster than expected. The other problem is Muslims don't necessarily integrate particularly well in France and in America and elsewhere. They tend to be a strain in social services. Muslims that come to America are disproportionately university educated. From the numbers I've seen, the average Muslim in America is better educated and makes more money than the average American. And Muslims who come here also come here, one, because a lot of them go to college here. Secondly, they come here for economic reasons. And third, they know if they come here, their children are going to grow up in a very different world than they grew up. So it's a self-selecting population, very different from the European Muslim populations. As Europe gets into deeper and deeper financial hot water, I think its ability to sustain a non-productive and less educated population will also be smaller. So I don't see the Muslim takeover of Europe being a linear thing. It's a very complex thing, and it's differentiated country by country. What I'm more concerned, I'm not denying that there is an increase in the population in Europe, it's that in those countries which have gone through this sudden demographic transition, you have problems which really have no real solution. The case of Egypt, I mean, you have, what do you do with the 45% of the population who are illiterate? I think you're going to have boat people landing in Greece. That will be a real crisis. You began to have that during the Libyan War. But I think you'll have a lot of really desperate people turning up in Europe who aren't wanted. What happens then?
David,
yes. Yes.
So I want to turn back to Iran for a second. The U.S. has been having an interesting on and off negotiation with the Iranians in regard to nuclear weapons, where we want to insist that they turn the clock back. And I'm interested in the implications of what you're describing, you know, from the standpoint of fertility. Long term, we should just wait them out. They'll go away.
Yes.
But short term, we have a big problem, which is that they'll have nuclear weapons. And is there anything that we could pull from this analysis that would help us strategically to actually move forward in the negotiations we're having, attempting to have with Iran?
Well, if the Iranians really have an apocalyptic sense of their own prospective extinction, and one reads that in the speeches of Ahmadinejad himself, this is, I'm not imputing this, you read really florid rhetoric, then my conclusion would be, under no circumstances can we permit people like that to have nuclear weapons. The mindset of which reminds me the most is that of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi leadership in the 1940s, who also had an apocalyptic Wagnerian sense of the doom of the Aryan race and the thought that this was their last chance at conquest, and otherwise they'd pull the world down around them. So my own view would be, use force if necessary, subversion, really whatever is required to prevent them from getting nuclear weapons. The difficulty is that having let them dig in for so many years, were we to, for example, use bombing at this point, it would not be pinpoint bombing, it would not be surgical, it would be a very long and messy campaign to decapitate the government and the military and destroy communications and so forth. It would involve a lot of collateral damage, a lot of civilians would die. That's the best, I mean, one thing that I really don't know much about is the mechanics of aerial attacks. It's not my field, but to the extent I've spoken with people who are in position to know, I've been told that it would be quite difficult. Tragically, that kind of thing, in my view, may be necessary. That's why I said part of my intent is to harden your hearts. Yes.
Yeah, thank you very much for your remarks. I find them very depressing. But I'm reminded of a New York Times bestseller that I've just read called Radical by an evangelical Christian named Michael Platt, who says many of the same things you said. But his reply is, don't harden your hearts if you are a Bible-believing Christian. But while there's still time, reach the world with the gospel. And the subtitle of the book is Saving Ourselves from the American Dream, which says if the world is in this condition, let's circle the wagons and try to preserve our American way of life and our comfortable security and manage, which is sort of your policy when speaking about what should American foreign policy do. He doesn't look at things on that big scale, but says to the American people who at one time, not too long ago, considered themselves a Christian people, that if you really believe this Christian gospel, then your job is to be concerned not about yourself. He quotes Jesus and says, if any man come to me, let him deny himself and follow me and take the message of God's love to these people who are perishing from your comfortable American household into the rest of the world. Don't harden your heart. Believe the gospel.
Well, if I may, speaking as an observant Jew, I think one of the most heartening things in the world is the work of more than 110,000 American missionaries around the world, who are doing fabulous stuff in Africa and Asia. We have the fastest rate of evangelization of Christians in the world ever in history. 10% of the Chinese population, by government estimates, are Christians. Exactly what that means, you know, one can argue about, but and these are mainly American-style denominations. So to the extent that the American model and American values are spreading, they're spreading more quickly through Christian evangelization in the global South than by any other means. I think this is a wonderful thing. And when evangelicals talk about that, I very much respect their view on this, though, of course, they're not sending missionaries into Iran because they get killed.
With this upbeat, nice upbeat point, which
let me just bring this to close. This reminds me of Woody Allen's line, "I'm sorry if I can't leave you with something positive, would you accept two negatives?" I see a question lingering over there, but I think we have to, let me take the equivalent of a station break to let people know. You've wandered into a meeting of the Committee for the American Founding, a group that encompasses three generations of Amherst people from the class of 1943 to now the class of 15, and contains some of my favorite early students and their children who have also been my students. And the purpose of this group was to try to preserve somewhere the curriculum of Amherst College, the teachings of the American founders and Lincoln on natural rights. And that's why we've come together. And we come together in the fall and the spring, sometimes here and sometimes in Washington. We should really, now we've learned a lesson, we really should do this at Parents Weekend. People are going to leave, we're going to have a business meeting with the trustees, then we're going to come back here for reception at 6, and then some of us will leave here for dinner, but these people, I think, coming to join us at the reception, you're invited in. If you'd like to be on our mailing list, leave me an email for you. This man is just very generous in his patience. Can we just get one more question in and then say...
Sure, and I'll hang around a bit.
Quite brief.
Yeah.
The gentleman's point certainly understood, and your concern about something possibly positive. Last night, I happened to hear a news cast that stated America will not enforce the no-fly zone over Iran if Israel decides to send aircraft.
Over Iran?
Iraq, I'm sorry.
There's a lot of speculation about that. To be honest, I don't know anything more about that, the details of that, that you could read in the media. As I stated my view that we simply can't afford to have Iran have nuclear weapons, but exactly how that should be done or who should do it, that's out of my area.
We have the flask this year with how many sons in Israel now?
Two
sons in Israel.
Call out the board. And Hadley, as soon as Shabbat is over, I'm going to inscribe it.
That's
you.
Right. Now, listen, thank you all for coming in. I think the learned lesson is we should do this every week, every time at Parents Weekend, but also have David in every time for Parents Weekend. Thanks very much.